notable entry in the diary of midwife Frau K., now long deceased, who bore witness to the first unaccompanied breaths of Nathanael Hornblower on an early winter morning in Waldhusche-Schaltberg, the Appenzell, Switzerland, December 1922. The boy's parents, Jan and Gael, were modest third-generation goat herders. They gave me what I needed. A brutally hard work ethic, a skin as thick as buck leather, and an immunity to pain, both physical or emotional. He was taught well in the family trade and learned the mysteries of milk, cheese, and mutton. But it was Hornblower's aunt, Lena Hornblower-Klapisch, an actress in the famous Lustig Burnet Theater Company, based in Zurich, who awakened the boy to the possibilities of the dramatic arts and a life outside the village. Jan Hornblower. Twice each year, my sister Lena came for another season. She would sit with little Nathanael around the tapakesflistet spot and tell him about the latest role she'd play. Meanwhile, she would recite every line of dialogue from scene one to final curtain. It was agony. For the next 6 months, Nathanael would recreate the plays. He constructed a stage out of fallen timber and fence joistings. He painted spectacular backdrops on the walls of the milking barn. He stitches and sewed and rehearsed all night. Jan again. He was a peculiar, weird, strange little shepherd. On Hornblower's 10th birthday, Lena arrived at the cabin with a gift. An 11.5 indirect sound Leica Cubicam. By the following September, Hornblower had written, directed, photographed, and starred in 72 short and featured film productions. The only surviving print among this masterful juvenile is an adaptation of one of Aunt Lena's great stage triumphs, Kilbler's Those Roaring Americans. It was invited to premiere at the prestigious Kinotheke Expo in Berlin that spring. Nathanael traded his winter earnings, plus a slaughtered goat, free chicken, and he booked his train fare. Then came Hitler. It would be a decade before Nathanael shot another foot of film. The rest we know. After the war, Hornblower would become one of the great voices of the Swiss New Wave. Inventive, prolific, enigmatic. The most curious thing about Nathanael's picture, wrote Frau K. in a later entry, whatever the story, comedy, tragedy, thriller, they invariably conclude with exactly the same gesture. The entire cast doubled over in absurd, hysterical, hopeless laughter. As if he knew, from the start, where I must end. Perhaps the midwife knew him best. Jean-Michel Kubelk. A Distant Yodel, also by Wes Anderson. The following conversation takes place on the set of A Distant Yodel, the film that remains most revered among all in the Nathanael Hornblower oeuvre. The picture's young star, Blitzenbergen, struggling through the 89th take of the famous extreme close-up of his tearful reunion with the mute lumberjack, cries to his master, I have done it in every which way I can think up. Can't you fix it in the cutting room later? Loop it or something? I'm losing my mind and my voice. Hornblower clears the set, sending the crew off to smoke and mutter around the frozen cedars below. He motions to the boy, who follows him up the ramp path to the crest of a frosty butte. He points across the valley to the stone emergency hutch at the peak of Mount Wesselwurst. He says quietly, you see that emergency hutch up there? For 3 generations, it has stood at the ready for climbers stranded by storm and avalanche. It has never failed them. Jonberger nods, interested but drawing a blank. Hornblower continues. It was built carefully, stone by stone, with unbroken devotion. If a stone fails, the hutch falls, and the climbers all freeze in their sleep and die. Finally, the boy understands, and so perhaps truly began his long career in Alpine cinema. He says to his master, every shot is a stone in the hutch. The master shakes his head. Every shot, Blitzen, is the hutch. Apocryphal? Possibly. Nevertheless, this account perfectly encapsulates Hornblower's approach to his lifelong heart. I went to visit the unremarkable but symbolic stone emergency hutch one winter afternoon 5 years ago, along with a group of friends, critics, and academics, all disciples of the maestro who had died in his sleep 1 week earlier. The climb itself was uneventful. The projection equipment had been carried up and installed in advance by a team of Tyrolean Sherpas and stage technicians. A light lunch of smoked cheese and bretzel awaited us at the mountain's midpoint. A thunderhead rolled in like a panzer division at sundown, and we were snowed into the cozy but poorly ventilated structure for the next 9 days straight. We had planned an overnight marathon of the cream of the crop, the best of Hornblower's cinema, his 6 great masterpieces to be accompanied by a feast of sandwiches, wine, jerky, local beer, dry sausages, schnapps, and good Swiss tobacco. By the time we emerged after the thaw, we had seen each of the films projected on a flax linen sheet stretched end-to-end across the interior of the sturdy building a minimum of 11 times. One of them, 16. Indeed, the last jerky rations ran out 3 days before we could safely open the hatch. The films themselves became our only sustenance. And it was our good fortune that electrical power to the projector was generated by a stout goat lard stove. Goat lard was the only thing never in short supplies that week. Curiously, the projection was only enhanced by the slow evolution of the color of the flax linen from white to a yellowy beige due to pipe smoke, goat grease, and the stench of human sweat. It was like an igloo in there, an igloo of cinematic art to the highest caliber. In a sense, we felt we had never seen the films before. I can assure you, we will never see them again. But I think it was the most correct and fitting NH memorial one could have ever imagined, to see the films continuously as if they were one. One hutch. And also to see them in the actual emergency hutch. JMK, in memoriam.
Best of All by Adam Horovitz, read by Elvis Costello. After the mix-up record came out, we went on tour. It's the usual thing that happens. You make a record, then you go on tour to promote that record. Then after that, you do it all over again. But we'd been doing that usual thing for such a long time that we wanted to make this next traveling adventure different for us. A band on tour spends so much time together at airports, in vans, at restaurants, etc., that you feel like a sports team headed to a city to play some other sports team. We always wanted to travel in matching outfits that really gave us that team look, but we never took the time to make it happen. So we decided that finally something had to be done about this serious issue. And we executed a mandatory mix-up dress code while we were traveling. No shitty backpacks, down coats or beanies allowed. Briefcases, old suits, trench coats, and pens in button-down shirt pockets were required. We looked like a group of traveling insurance salesmen from 1966. We wanted the audience at our shows to dress up too. We called the tour the gala event and said that if you showed up wearing Tevas and cargo shorts, you'd get turned away at the door. Most people just arrived in their normal t-shirts and whatevers and were allowed entry. But it was wonderful to look out into the audience and see a few die-hard B-Boys fans dressed for a gala event. We know who you are and we love you. Thank you for taking this shit as seriously as we do. But all of this is a non-story, really. It's more of an explanation, a backstory to a photograph that I took of Michael Lewis Diamond just after the very last show we ever played in the UK at the Bestival Festival on the Isle of Wight. The rule of Best of All is that you have to go in costume, so everyone in the audience was dressed up. Best of All was in a big open field somewhere in the middle of the Isle of Wight, a place you had to take a cool old ferry to get to. The view was spectacular, like all the great seaside scenes from Quadrophenia. The ferry brought us closer and closer, to a beautiful open British landscape. It was a gorgeous sunny day, and it was so refreshing not to have to drive through a sea of miserable punters drenched in rain and mud, like every other UK festival we ever played. Instead, we were greeted by the festival attendees, who were as sunny as the day was, and had put a lot of energy into the costumes they were wearing. They were prepped as fuck. They were like 20 Smurfs, a bunch of gnomes and wizards and pirates. 5 dudes dressed like a row of foosball, tethered together all day and night, and they were loving it. The unwritten rule was that the bands didn't have to wear costume, but since we were still in the mix-up dress code mode, we arrived already ready. Because we were the night's headliner, we could play an encore if the crowd wanted it. We finished our show and went to our designated backstage area and waited a couple of minutes to see if these nice people wanted a couple more original classic smash hits from the legendary Beastie Boys. And you know what? They did. We went back out there on stage, but soon noticed that Mike had gone missing. We waited an awkward couple of minutes, and then Mike came barreling out on stage in a brand new special outfit that he'd stashed away, just waiting for the proper occasion to break it out. Mike coming back out on stage in his special outfit was like you went to the movies and your friend went to the bathroom and came back as Captain Crunch. It was hilarious and necessary, and in retrospect, the perfect way to exit the country we love and that loves us back. We've had a rocky relationship, us in England, but true love prevails. Oi. P.S. We were later in a lengthy lawsuit with a beverage company, and this picture of Mike was introduced as evidence. The image was blown up to stand about 3 feet tall, and then it was mounted on cardboard. It was suitable for framing. I'm not sure what their purpose was to have this wonderful photograph brought in as evidence. But to me, it was proof that outfits are important. And that, on this night, Mike fucking nailed it.
No One Seemed to Notice, by Adam Horovitz. We had a big idea for the music going into recording our last record, Hot Sauce Committee Part 2. Every song would be made of a fake sample. It was meant to be a sort of record collector's unattainable nightmare. Wait. What's that record they sampled? I never heard it. How come I don't own that record? We listed each fake sample in the liner notes on the artwork, complete with fake song titles, band names, and fictitious record labels. Unfortunately, not only do people not study album art the way they used to, but big ideas are irrelevant in the pop music medium. The song itself will always trump whether it's an interesting idea or not. If there's no big beat to dance to or big chorus to sing along with, who cares? If you're not a hardcore baseball nerd, it doesn't really matter if that last pitch was a curveball or a slider. All you care about is that it struck out the side to eventually win the game, and now you're happy. Or your team lost and so you're sad. Either way, the curveball was insignificant. As a band, we've had both. The songs to get behind and scream with in your car, and the duds that have some cockamamie idea that only we are aware of and think is funny. Making those fake samples was laborious, though. When you sample a piece of music, you don't just sample the beat or guitar part or vocal thing you want. There are always random, unintentional, and mostly unheard sounds that come with it. Maybe it's the sound of the bass player touching her strings, getting ready to start playing just after your sample bar of music. Or the singer taking a deep breath before he's about to sing. Or the echo or reverb from the string section that just finished playing their part and it's carried over into the little piece you want to sample. You don't notice it until you've looped it and heard it 100 times. There's almost always some tiny, obscure, off-chance sound that's buried in that drum beat or guitar line you sampled. We wanted to experiment with unpremeditated audio, create those slightly unheard sounds. To take imaginary recordings that we imagined finding on imaginary 45s at imaginary yard sales, bookstores, and record shops, and then put ourselves in the studio with them. We spent days recording Mike's drumming. We'd mix the sound so it sounded like a sampled beat, and then we'd sample Mike's drumming into one bar or half bar loops to really have that chopped up sample feel. Sometimes we quietly add the sounds off of actual old records popping from the needle to really make it feel like it was from an old beat-up record. Then we'd record some weird vocal or horns or piano just before it, but not during, so you could kind of vaguely hear something else going on, the trail of the sounds that came before. Same went for any bass, guitar, or keyboard parts we recorded. We spent a ton of time making these fake samples and the fictitious musicians that created them to put in the credits, but no one seemed to notice. Not one person has mentioned it to me. I guess no one ever says to you, yo, I heard your new record. Those liner notes are the shit.
When we listened to what we'd recorded, we thought the song sounded muffled and muddy and needed to be brightened up a bit. Yauk said, how about if we work with Philippe Zadar? Horovitz and I were like, Philippe Zahu? What? What does this guy know about what we do? Yauk and his daughter Lose were obsessed with Phoenix's record, Listomania, which Zadar had mixed. Yauk somehow sold us on seeing what Zadar could do on a few tracks. It turned out Zadar had a hip-hop background pre-dance and pop music, but most important, he was really what we needed at the time. Zadar would obsess over every detail of sound. He is a master at gear manipulation. Yauk would join in, literally, right beside him, hands on deck, fingers on faders at the legendary Electric Lady Studios on West 8th Street, where Hendrix used to record.
We had recorded so much material for this album that we decided to break it up into two different volumes, parts 1 and 2. They had an elaborate idea behind them about the human ascension from cave dwellings to the Wright brothers' attempt at reaching the stars in Kitty Hawk, North Carolina, and onward past the Mars rover. Unfortunately, there's no interesting story behind why we only released part 2. The long and short of it is this. While doing research on travel during the Great Depression for part 2, we left the hard drive for part 1 on a boxcar somewhere outside Missoula, Montana. It's gone. Only part 2 remains. Getting into the details of what was going on personally with us after the recording came out is a heavy thing to write about. It was unintentionally our last record. The band didn't break up, we didn't go our own creative ways, no solo project fucked things up to cause animosity. This was our last record because Adam got cancer and died. If that hadn't happened, we would probably be making a new record right now. Sadly, it didn't turn out that way. Sadly. Sadly. Too fucking sad to write about. This record is one of my favorites because of the writing-recording process. We were all in, together. It felt like 1992, creatively. We were getting deep with audio experimentation. We were on some new shit, again. Ideas were overflowing. We spent a lot of time making this gift, and I hope you enjoy it. But please don't bring up the fake sample credits in the liner notes the next time we see each other, because I'll know that you heard this and that you're just trying to be nice by mentioning it, and let's just not do that, okay? Thanks. Make Some Noise. This might be my favorite song of ours. I used to think it was Intergalactic, or So What You Want, or maybe even Gratitude. I do really like Right Now, too. Anyways, the thing about Make Some Noise is the track. It's kind of like what I wanted our instrumentals to sound like, but never really achieved. Hard-driving funk, funky like Whoa. I love that it's us playing and rapping. We didn't really do that too much. Our rap songs had samples, and our playing songs were either instrumentals or had more traditional screaming-style vocals, Sabotage, Gratitude, etc. It makes me pretty sad that we never got to play the song live in concert, for a lot of different reasons, but for the most part, it would have been really fun to play, and you would have loved it. It would have been a show closer, one that would have sent you out onto the streets like, what's next? Okay. We wanted to make a new wave rap song. That may not be so evident in the end result, but that was the goal going in. We've talked about punk rock and hardcore so much in this book, but I want to give special acknowledgement to some of my favorite bands ever. Punks that made music that didn't have a traditional punk sound, so they got lumped into this other category called New Wave. Devo, Blondie, Elvis Costello, B-52s, Adam and the Ants, and so many more. Too Many Rappers, New Reactionaries version, featuring Nas. Yauk was a terrible drummer, worse than me. He oddly would only play this one specific John Bonham-ish beat every time he sat behind the drum kit. In typical Yauk form, he wouldn't do the simple thing, just play an easy 4-4 pattern, kick, snare, kick, snare, Same with him being an untrained acoustic-based jazz musician or filmmaker. He'd always just swing for the fences. But again, the wonderful thing about sampling music is, you can kind of suck as a drummer, but be able to find that one perfect bar to loop. And that's what this song has. He must have felt so satisfied after years of playing that same sloppy off-time beat, to now have it so locked in, sounding just the way he'd wanted it to. And that same thing that drove me and Mike crazy now sounds booming. We made a basic idea for a track and sent it to Nas to see if he liked it and would possibly record a verse or two over it. Within a week or two, he recorded some vocals and sent it back to us. This never happens with big-timers in the popular music realm. Things take forever, with 30 emails back and forth between managers and publicists, and maybe after 3 months you'll get a yes, but the thing won't ever actually happen. Nas is a wonderful person and a true professional. Thank you. Cut to, 6 months later. We start doing final mixes on all the songs, and Yauch felt like this song wasn't all it could be and needed something. Unbeknownst to me and Mike, he went into the studio at night, took away all the music that we made, and played his Superfuzz Terminator bass from the beginning to the end of the song. We showed up to put the final touches on the song, only to find that the track is completely different. It never occurred to Yauch that it might be a weird thing to do. That maybe his bandmates might get upset that he totally changed the thing that we made together, without consulting us. And that's the gift and the curse of being in a band with Adam Yauch. He did a ton of stuff over the years without first checking with me or Mike. It drove us nuts. And it was just as infuriating that he was always right. In the end, the song sounded really good, and it was so satisfying to all three of us that Adam got to go wild on his favorite thing, the Superfuzz Terminator bass, and that his John Bonham dream got fulfilled. The Bill Harper Collection. This is one of 100 answering machine messages from our longtime accountant, Bill Harper. We felt that after so many years of him trying to track us down for mundane answers to mundane questions, we should at least honor him by giving him the weirdest of shout-outs. Don't Play No Game That I Can't Win, featuring Santi Gold. We wanted to make a real-sounding dub reggae song and rap over it, a track like King Tubby Meets Rockers Uptown. We also love Santi Gold's record and were becoming friends with her because we had just played some shows together. Wouldn't it be amazing to have her sing on this song? So we asked her, and she said yes. That's basically the whole story to the song, except that Santi wanted Switch to co-produce. We were uncomfortable at first because we liked to be in control of these things, but we love Santi's record and in turn love Switch because he produced a bunch of it. Since Licensed to Ill, letting go of complete control was difficult for us. But the lyrics that Santi wrote were great, as were Switch's ideas for editing and production, and so there you go. We managed to collaborate on someone else's terms and made a song that we love. Long Burn the Fire. When you buy a lot of records looking for samples, there's always a couple that have a great little vocal line with music under it that sound amazing. But often those vocal lines are too odd to base a song around. We wanted to embrace those weirdo samples and make a fake sample from a fake song called Shallow Water. It was an imaginary tale of the supernatural in the bayou of Louisiana. A line from that fake sample from that fake song went, "Long burn the fire, the truth shall set you free." We liked it so much that after we recorded the fake sample, we made a whole song that was the actual fake song from the fake sample. A totally backward way of sampling and songwriting. It was an experiment in experimenting, and it was intensely fucking fun doing it. The role of the 70s New Orleans crooner Diane Wentworth was played by my best friend, Nadia Dejani. Crazy Ass Shit. The thing of audible note on here is Mike's kids. We told the two of them to say On and On to the Break of Dawn and recorded it. They were such adorable children, and now they're knucklehead teenagers who surf and listen to Black Flag all day. Just like their dad. I know it's not as cool to them as guesting on a Slayer record when they were four, but I hope that at least one kid in their school thinks it is. The Lisa Lisa Full Force Routine. This song is actually from the tail end of Hot Sauce Committee Part 1. It was meant to be the bridge between the two records. The first half of this song is on a hard drive somewhere. It was in a small maroon and purple duffel bag with a gray piping on the sides, If you find either of these things, the drive or the bag, please contact me. I really want them back.
Yauk, Filmmaker, by Adam Horovitz, read by Kelly Riker. What fucking if? Recently I did an interview for a documentary about Spike Jonze. It was about his movies and how they affected people and what it was like to work with them, all that sort of stuff. In the middle of talking about how weird and funny and wonderful Spike is, I unconsciously said something about how easy it would be to be sitting here talking about what a great filmmaker Adam Yauch is. I paused on that and kind of drifted off for a moment. In my mind, I could see a movie montage of the documentary about the film director Adam Yauch. He was accepting awards, giving charming and inspiring speeches. Film school teachers were lecturing to students about the career of Adam Yauch, about how he and Spike Jonze and a handful of others changed the way we think about filmmaking, reimagined the guerrilla style, a style that's simultaneously disheveled and frantic, yet introspective and thoughtful, smart and dumb. A quick cut to an interviewer commenting to Yauch about how amazing it is that he'd created such a diverse body of work, and how he'd finesse his actors into giving performances for the ages. Specifically, that most recent film. The one that made you cry and barf and want to drive like a maniac. All made with a seemingly effortless fun technique. Hey, you guys, let's make a movie. And then, in a flash, I was snapped back into the room, talking to a camera about Spike. I've certainly had these thoughts about Adam plenty of times before, but they all came into focus that day. He had greatness in him. He knew it, and so did we. What fucking if, right? Damn.
The Last Gig, by Adam Horovitz. We didn't know it was going to be the last gig we'd ever play. Everything that happened that day was totally normal. The gig was headlining a huge festival in Tennessee called Bonnaroo. Thousands and thousands of people were going to be there, and we were the headliner. We went down to Tennessee early because we were going to shoot a video for a new song that hadn't come out yet. It was us, the rapper Nas, and Roman Coppola, the director. It was oddly normal for us to play these huge concerts and have Roman Coppola with a Bolex camera filming us and Nas running around a supermarket and on some train tracks in Tennessee. The weirder, the more normal for us by then. We'd only met Nas a couple times, so we didn't know if he'd be cool with our style of making videos, which is basically walk or drive around until you see something interesting to stand in front of or do something stupid in front of. Not all big-time professionals are into the sort of winging it thing. Nas seemed right at home, which was great because we didn't have a plan B. He did seem a little thrown off at first, like, wait, we're literally gonna just walk around this random supermarket and lip-sync the song into the camera? That's it? We don't have to wait around for hours while someone has to move a light or wait for someone person to get some other person a Frappuccino? Great. Let's roll. So that's what we did all morning. We made a video. When we'd finished, we went to the massive field where the festival was happening to hang out and then play our show. Things in life never come full circle. Maybe once or twice they're hexagonal, but to me they're almost always misshapen, as if drawn by a toddler in crayon. There's some common threads, sure. Yauch and me and Mike were still together. Still laughing, still family. Al Green was finishing his set on one of the many stages of the festival, and so hearing his voice in the distance was comforting, just like how it was when I was in high school, in my bedroom waiting for my friends to come over. But now was such a great distance from then. The rear view was nearly impossible to reposition. Kate wasn't there with us in Tennessee. Jill Kniff and Ronna Harris and Tanya Abbey. John Barry wasn't there. Dave Skilkin, Bosco, the captain, Dave Parsons, Mike's dad, my mom, and so many more. Not there. Me, Adam, and Mike were older, and we knew it. Still very much in the game, though. Getting ready to start all over again. Headlining a huge festival is very different from a nice turnout at CBGB's. But shit, man, we didn't know it was going to be the last show we'd ever play.
Yauch Mixtape by Michael Diamond. One of the many things I loved about Yauch was that he could really fixate on a song. We all do this to a degree, playing a record over and over again, lifting the needle up, dropping it back down, pressing stop and rewind on a cassette, but Yauch would take it exponential. He would listen to a song again and again and again, memorizing every word, phrase, bass line, and production trick. He just absorbed music in a slightly different way. I think this is why he was technically a better rapper than either Adam or me, and a better musician too. He put the time in. He obsessed in a good way. Here are some songs that'd be guaranteed to be on a Yauch mixtape. Bad Brains Roar Tape. Maybe the single record that changed the world for Yauch. Actually, it was a cassette tape. It stayed in constant rotation for as long as Yauch sported Bad Brains t-shirts, and that was until the very end, y'all. I think this inspired him to want to be in a band and play bass for sure. Alternative Ulster, Stiff Little Fingers. When I went to Yauch's house for the first time, this was the very first song he put on. I knew the song already, but definitely had not played it as many times as he did. I preferred The Clash, but Stiff Little Fingers was his band for sure. What Do I Get? Buzzcocks. This was on heavy rotation in Yauch's State Street bedroom. I also remember listening to this a lot at our friend Sarah Cox's Crosby Street loft, where we gathered on many a weekend, running around a desolate and deserted Soho. We all loved this song. The hyper, overambitious drums and bass, the vocals, the lyrics, all of it. Kiss Me Deadly, Generation X. I have a specific memory of sleeping over at Ronna Harris's house in the West Village and all of us young teen punk rock kids waking up in this very cool actual artist loft and Yauch playing this corny song over and over. Public Image and also Careering, Public Image Limited. Yauch played the Public Image bass line hundreds of times. I'm sure so many people learning to play bass did the same thing. Pressure Drop, Toots and the Maytals. From the soundtrack to The Harder They Come, we love this film, one of the all-time great soundtracks ever. I remember going to see this and Rockers with Yauch at the New Yorker Theater on the Upper West Side. These movies lit a fire and made us want to discover reggae. Fight Dem Back, Linton Kwesi Johnson. Smash Their Brains In, 'Cause They Ain't Got Nothing In 'Em, became kind of an anti-racist, anti-skinhead anthem for a minute. LKJ inspired us. Exodus, Bob Marley and the Wailers. Who hasn't listened to Bob Marley 1 million times? If Yauch put this on and saw that you weren't feeling it, this mischievous smile would appear on his face and he would kind of dance over to you and get you all excited to hear it again after all. Spoon and Rap, Spoony G. The first rap song where Yauch had every word, every inflection, every cadence down. Just a few years later, he would perform a verse from this record when we were on the Madonna tour, as we had only 3 rap songs we could play as a group at that point. Sucker MC's Run DMC. The rap song that changed the game for us and everybody. It was a true summertime anthem of a melting hot, sticky, New York City summer during which you would hear the signature drum machine hand clap and runs 2 years ago a friend of mine bouncing off buildings and flooding avenues with this revolutionary sound. That same summer, Yauch had a Froze-Aid cart and we'd go hang out with him on the street and blast this song out of a transistor radio. Froze-Aid was this super sweet frozen lemonade that kind of blew up for one summer and then just as quickly the carts disappeared. Yauch caught the Froze-Aid wave. Baby Let Me Follow You Down, Bob Dylan. When we lived together on Christie Street, Yauch co-opted my copy of Bob Dylan's first album and played the shit out of it. Yauch loved this record and would recite the spoken word intro to this song all the time, mimicking Dylan's voice, sounding like he had a cheek full of tobacco. First heard this from Rick Von Schmidt. By the time I get to Arizona, Public Enemy. Yauch couldn't believe someone other than us had made a rap song over a crazy fuzz bass line. It merged one of his favorite rappers of all time with his favorite instrument of all time, epic fuzz bass. We are also alternately inspired by and jealous of Public Enemy's It Takes a Nation of Millions, which Yauch played on the boomin' system in his Cadillac Fleetwood Brougham de Elegance because it made us question whether what we were making was even worthwhile. Damn, they did it. We'll never make something this good. Freedom, Jimi Hendrix. This could have come at any point in this playlist, because Jimi Hendrix was probably the most influential solo artist for Yauch. He has so many different amazing songs and albums, it's kind of a disservice to pick just one. Take It Easy, Jackson Browne. Another anomalous cut. I mean, who knew? Yauch? A Jackson Browne fan? Yauch volunteered at the New York City No Nukes concert, and it really stuck with him. Just goes to show, speak your mind, organize, you can influence people in untold ways. Yauch listened to this on the License to Ill tour bus. He also played it on guitar, and it borderline influenced what he wanted to do with his side band, Brooklyn. Promised Land, Big Fat Love. This was my side band, but Yauch loved Big Fat Love more than I ever did, especially this song. He even recorded this on his own, all sneaky-like, just an acoustic guitar, bass, and vocals in different studios at different times without even telling us. Slivative, Back Door. A G-Sun, Check Your Head era classic that we would listen to on repeat. Yauch would next level study this jam, bunkered down in his Laurel Canyon log cabin. The White Album, The Beatles. Of all the Beatles albums, Yauch was most inspired by the innovative and varied production of this one. Fun fact, for one of Adam Horovitz's teenage birthdays, Yauch gave him every Beatles studio album because he only owned Rubber Soul at the time. Aguas de Marzo, Antonio Carlos Jobim, and Alice Regina. While we were making Hello Nasty, we went through a major Brazilian music phase. All types of stuff, traditional to psychedelic. Yauch favored the classics. Two words, Kanye West. Yauch would often fixate on non-album cuts. Example A, Yauch really wanted to work with Duro on To the Five Boroughs, based on some of the records he mixed for Kanye. 1901, Phoenix. This ultimately led to us working with mixer, producer, and esteemed colleague, Philippe Zadar. Honorable mentions. Typical Girls, The Slits. Change, Killing Joke. Fade Away, New Age Steppers. Brand New Life, Young Marble Giants. Filler, Minor Threat. Subculture, Cockney Rejects. Genius Rap, Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. Freedom, Grandmaster Flash and the Furious Five. I'm Somebody Else's Guy, Frederick MC Count Linton. Buffalo Gals, Malcolm McLaren. Yo, Bum Rush the Show, Public Enemy. The Well's Gone Dry, The Crusaders. Rock the Mic, Beanie Siegel and Freeway. 1251, The Strokes. When the Sun Goes Down, Arctic Monkeys. Outro by Michael Diamond. Congratulations, you've made it through the entire book. It probably wasn't easy, and it certainly wasn't quick. I wish I had a golden ticket or a prize that I could give you, but I don't. Yes, we were and are some lucky ducks. We were teenagers living in a chaotic city where anything was possible and everything was okay, even when it wasn't. We were young, making music, becoming famous, then infamous, then not so famous, making money and losing money, making friends and losing friends, making mistakes and sometimes learning from mistakes. And through it all, we were super fortunate to somehow remain close friends. To Adam and me, Yauch was like our older brother, and even more, a mentor. Over the years, the band transformed from a nonstop recording and touring machine into something sustainable, something that we could all come back to when we wanted and needed it. Grown-up things happened to us. We had our own families, kids, separate interests, the whole deal. But we'd still come together to have fun and make stuff. And we would be coming back together today if Yauch were still alive. So we leave you with this picture. Yauch flies to some mountains at the edge of the earth, hops out of a helicopter to perfect snowboarding conditions. Virgin pow, as they say. No one is around. Sure, he packs his gear, but what else? A pillow? A favorite stuffed animal to cuddle? Nope. He brings a ginormous upright bass and carries that shit up the mountain. Physically and metaphorically, this is a big deal. crazy and funny and amazing and something that your mom, travel agent, accountant, and manager would all advise against. But it captures the spirit that marked a lot of the adventures Yauch led us on. And this is why whenever I have the opportunity to do a random kind of crazy thing, something I feel I have no business doing, I ask myself, what would Yauch do?
This is Ralph Ryan. We hope you enjoyed this production of Beastie Boys book by Michael Diamond and Adam Harlan. This program was produced by Scott Sherritt and Dan Zick. Directed by Scott Sherritt and Travis Tunn. Recorded all over the world. Thank you to all the studios and engineers who helped make this happen. A special thanks to Peter Smith, John Silver, and Luke Jenkins. Edited, mixed, and mastered by Danny Meltz. Additional editing by Jake Romero Winegrove. Text copyright 2018 Beastie Boys Partnership. White Boy Booyah Bay. Copyright 2018. Leatham and Blake Leatham. Productions, copyright 2018. Penguin, Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.